Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to another WriteStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann, and I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon. If you are an American, I hope you had a very lovely Memorial Day weekend, but I also hope that you took some time to remember the fallen and those who have died in service to our country and the preservation of our freedom. I think sometimes, unfortunately, in our culture today, that gets completely overlooked, and we tend to think of it as nothing more than a three-day weekend. So I hope you thanked a soldier, thanked a member of the military, at least said some prayers for them and thought about them. I know I have some veterans in my family who have passed on, and we can't thank them enough. It's because of them that we live in a free country. And just for those of you who don't know me, before I go any further, my name is Daria Ann, and I am an independent author of a book called Water Signs, A Story of Love and Renewal. I'm also a ghostwriter. I'm currently writing a book for a client, social media marketer, editor, blogger. You can find me at dariadigiovanni.com. And in addition to that, I am the founder of the WriteStream Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio, where I have two other hosts so far on the network, and I'm always looking for new talent. So anyone listening, if you know of anyone after hearing the show today, or if you yourself are an author and would like to express an interest in becoming a host on the network, please let me know. You can contact me through my blog or at Twitter, at Daria Ann, that's D-A-R-I-A-A-N-N-E. But my two other hosts right now are Lisa Tarvez. Lisa hosts a show called Just Believe every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, covering topics of spirituality, angelic communication, health and wellness, alternative therapies, metaphysical healing. It's a phenomenal show. She's had some really outstanding guests, and Lisa herself is an author. Her book is called Just Believe, and you can find it on Amazon. And again, her name is Lisa Tarvez. And then on Mondays, with the exception of this past Monday, of course, because it was a holiday, but military historian and journalist John D. Gresham hosts Military Monday, and obviously that show centers around issues pertaining to the United States military, and John also brings on experts in a variety of areas within that topic. So if you haven't heard his show or heard Lisa's show or previous WriteStream Tuesday episodes, and you're interested in listening to them, you can go to blogtalkradio.com/writestream. That's WriteStream, and check them out. We also have, for those of you who are on Twitter, a weekly WriteStream Twitter chat, and that runs every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern. All right, so because I want to stay on schedule here, and I have two wonderful guests, again, lined up for today, I want to go ahead and introduce my first guest, and how appropriate that I'm bringing him on here the day after Memorial Day. But his name is Montgomery J. Granger. He is a three-time mobilized U.S. Army Reserve major, retired, who resides in Long Island, New York, with his wife and five children. He's the author of Theodore, a personal narrative published in the 2006 Random House wartime anthology, Operation Homecoming, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Home Front in the words of the U.S. troops and their families. Today, we're going to be focusing mainly on his book, Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay, a memoir of a citizen warrior. And before I go ahead and bring him on the line, I'm just going to read a little description of his book, and then we're going to go ahead and delve into some of these topics. U.S. Army Reserve Captain Montgomery Granger found himself the ranking Army Medical Department officer in a joint military operation like no other before it, taking care of terrorists and murderers just months after the horrors of September 11, 2001. Granger and his fellow reservists end up running the Joint Detainee Operations Group, or JDOG, at Guantanamo Bay's infamous Camp X-Ray. In this moving memoir, Granger writes about his feelings of guilt, leaving his family and job back home, while in Guantanamo, he faces a myriad of torturous emotions and self-doubt, at once hating the inmates he is nonetheless duty-bound to care for and protect. Through long-distance love and much heartache, Granger finds a way to keep his sanity and dignity. Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay is his story. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to WriteStream Tuesday, Montgomery J. Granger and his book, Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay. Monty, are you there?
I'm here, Daria. Thank you so much for that very kind and generous introduction. I really appreciate it, and I'd like to thank everyone out there for tuning in.
Well, I want to thank you for your service to our country, Monty, and I mean that sincerely. I have so much respect and admiration for everyone who puts on the uniform, and in particular your story, because I think that, in my opinion, as a civilian, it had to be one of the most difficult jobs that anyone in the military could be tasked with, especially in the wake of September 11th. So why don't I start by just asking you to kind of tell us why you wrote your book, and then maybe we'll get into some specific topics that you discuss in it.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a very difficult job, and we found out right away that if you weren't well suited for that kind of work, meaning mentally and emotionally resilient to the attempts of the detainees to get in your head and intimidate you or bully you or generally freak you out, which is part of what they're trained to do, then bad things could happen. I chose to write the book for a couple of reasons. One is catharsis. Since I was about 7 years old, my mom gave me a diary, so I was very comfortable writing journal entries just about every day that I was there. And that's really the meat and potatoes of the book. The other reason I wrote the book was due to my frustration with the mainstream media, which we found out very quickly, we're not interested in telling any of the stories from our perspective, meaning the U.S. perspective. They were not interested, the mainstream media was not interested in telling the truth. There's at least one or two incidents in the book that I bring forward where mainstream media reporters tried to it's almost like a detainee, try to intimidate me or my bosses into giving them information, classified information, that would have compromised our mission. And then seeing the next day on a CNN crawl, things were not true. And in fact, one of the reporters admitted to us that they make it up. And I'm not, I don't want to generalize that person represents all reporters or all media, but it was an eye-opening experience.
Right, and and you know, I have to just interject here. Anybody who knows me knows that I'm not shy about expressing my opinions, and I am deeply disturbed. I mean, it goes beyond just being outraged, but I'm deeply disturbed by the obvious bias that's going on in the media that was, you know, that our founding fathers set up really as a watchdog for the people. Their job is to report the truth. And just as a civilian, I'll say this. I found that they're extremely biased, with a few exceptions. I mean, there are some exceptions. But by and large, if not for new media, you know, Blog Talk Radio, the blogosphere, people like Michelle Malkin, it would be that much more difficult for these stories to get out, for the truth to get out there. And that's just, you know, and I think that's just fact based on, you know, what we've seen, especially since September 11th. And, you know, I find it just incredible and stunning that the media would take the side of those who have made it very clear that their objective is to harm our country. So I know you may not, I'm just saying that as my opinion, because I certainly agree with you. And I want you to jump back in here. I mean, I was really, you know, in the wake of September 11th, and as soon as Gitmo was set up, you know, in this instance in particular, I was horrified at how, you know, the finger of blame was immediately pointed at the United States and the United States military in the media. So I'm thrilled that you've written this book, and I can't wait to, you know, to bring the truth to light here on my little internet radio program.
Well, God bless you. You're a rare bird. They are out there, people like you who are patriots and loyal to their country, and I'm just glad that I have this opportunity to share with you and your listeners. There was a couple of incidents, one at Guantanamo Bay and one later on in Iraq when I served there from 2004 to 2005, but I worked very closely with the International Committee of the Red Cross at Gitmo and at times had long conversations with their physicians. They're mostly made up of Swiss physicians. So, you know, we're sitting on the tarmac one day waiting for a shipment of detainees to come in, and I just, you know, off the cuff, I said, hey, where do we rank? Meaning, where does the United States rank in terms of how well we treat detained persons? And the physician looked me in the eye and he said, the U.S. is the best at, you know, what we do, detention operations. There's no one better than the United States of America. And I try to lead in with that concept in my book and take us throughout history. And what that meant to me was that every American can be proud of about 99.9% of those of us who serve in the detention field. And they are professional, they're hardworking, they're loyal, they have a great sense of duty, of service, and they just want to do the right thing. Everyone in the military pretty much wants to do their job and do it well. And that includes those in detention operations. And I think for the most part, again, 99.9% of all those working in detention operations, everyone can be very proud of the hard work that they do.
Absolutely. And it's very easy, you know, when you're a civilian and you're working in an office building every day or you have, you know, your cushy job where you don't have to worry about your life being in jeopardy, it's very easy to just point the finger of blame and join in on all this propaganda. So I'm just so glad that we're here today to kind of clear up a lot of these misconceptions. And Monty, you go to great lengths in your book of explaining how the United States treats its prisoners. So let's talk a little bit more about that. I know that the doctors from the Red Cross said that, you know, we treat them the best, but let's do a little, because in the book you do sort of a little comparison and contrast with some other countries. So let's talk a little bit about that and tell us what distinguishes the United States from other countries in that regard.
Well, we're a signatory to the Geneva Conventions, and our version of that is called the Law of Land Warfare, and it's Army Field Manual 27-10, and it's easily found on the Internet. And the International Committee of the Red Cross also published a pamphlet on the Geneva Conventions as they apply to military operations. So these were kind of my Bibles, and this is all before 9/11 took place. I got into the 800th Military Police Brigade, which is a reserve army unit solely for the purpose of enemy prisoner of war operations. And I joined the unit in late 1999. And in that unit at that time, were scores of officers, enlisted and non-commissioned officers, who had served in the first Gulf War. And if you remember that, back in 91, the United States held thousands of lawful combatant Iraqi prisoners of war. The war lasted about 10 days, and within days after that, we had released them all because they were covered under the conventions. They wore uniforms and rank. They carried their arms openly. Even if the country is not a signatory, if they follow the rules or the spirit of Geneva, then they can be treated within those rules. Now, we knew that the folks that we first captured were real bad guys because they had been involved in a prison uprising in Afghanistan. Within several weeks of that conflict, we had gathered hundreds of detainees in a prison, I believe in Mazar-e Sharif. And if you remember, Johnny Michael Spann was the first American killed in our operation in the fall of 2001. He was a CIA operative who was interviewing detainees in this makeshift prison, and there was an uprising. Some of the prisoners got hold of weapons, killing Johnny Michael Spann. We killed hundreds of them. It took several days to get them under control. So we knew the first guys over were real bad guys, and they were all unlawful combatants, meaning they didn't follow the rules of the Geneva Conventions. So we knew this going into it. My unit was very involved. The higher echelons were very involved in even selecting Guantanamo Bay as a place for this operation. So we knew that they did not meet the criteria of being covered. And what that means is, since the Geneva Conventions and Law of Land Warfare were written to protect innocent civilians during wartime, not to protect those who pretend to be civilians in order to murder them, i.e. the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Islamist extremists. So we knew that they weren't entitled. However, as soon as we got to Guantanamo Bay, they told us that they would be treated within the spirit of the Geneva Conventions. Donald Rumsfeld told my boss, "We know they're not covered, but you'll treat them within the spirit of Geneva." And that's really all we had to know, because that's what we were trained to do. And that's how we performed our duties. And other countries don't necessarily follow these rules. We'd mentioned before the show started, you might have had a question about torture and things of that nature. Well, in my book, I guess it's the most boring page, but the details of the definition of torture from 2005, the internationally accepted definition, I put in my book. And I put it there for a very specific reason. Because of all the free-flowing allegations that there was systematic torture at Guantanamo Bay are simply unfounded and untrue. But they do focus sometimes on waterboarding. The 2005 internationally accepted definition of torture doesn't cover waterboarding. It doesn't meet the definition. And there were those in our country who realized that. And in fact, the only people allowed to do something like that, which was called an approved enhanced interrogation technique, were those trained by the CIA. Detention operations are military operations, the incarceration part. The intelligence part, or extracting information or interviewing detainees for information that might save lives, is a joint mission between civilian organizations like the FBI, the CIA, and the military operation.
You okay?
Just taking a drink.
Oh, good.
lubricating the vocal cords. So, we have oversight. I was part of that oversight. My unit is detention operation liaison unit. So my job was to oversee the medical, preventive medical, and environmental aspects of the mission. I would write a daily report to my commander. I would attend all the detention operation medical staff meetings every day. I would observe procedures both at the camp and also at the detention hospital and report all of that. I would also read intelligence reports and extract medical information from that. Information include those in my report to my boss on a daily basis. Just get another drink here.
Absolutely. But Monte, I just want to interject while you're doing that a thought, because it's just, you know, I'm listening to you, and I'm, you know, and I kind of have mixed feelings. At one point, I'm, you know, it just reaffirms my love of this country, that we do things differently and we hold ourselves to a higher standard. But on the other hand, it angers me that so many clueless Americans who are just too influenced by pop culture and a biased media, that, you know, that they don't seem to understand the evil that's within these men. I mean, that these are really bad people who wish to do us harm. And yet, you know, and I should leave my personal opinions out of it, but yet they won't champion, let me just say this very quickly, the rights of the unborn. And I'm not asking you to weigh in on that debate, but I'm just simply saying I just find it really, just really, again, deeply disturbing that there's so many in this country who will go to bat for people who would kill them or behead them in a heartbeat and not even think about it. And at the same time, I've always been proud of my country, but I'm very proud that we do hold ourselves to a higher standard. But that's going to be very difficult for someone like you in the execution of it.
It is, and it's hard to keep your mouth shut, so I don't. I'm active on Twitter. I've written a book about it. I plan to follow a book about my year in Iraq, pretty much doing the same thing at different locations there. But yes, there is a movement, and I not so flatteringly call these people pagan, utilitarian, humanist, Islamist apologists. And most of the attorneys for the remaining detainees at Guantanamo Bay fit that category. They have a pagan ethics system. It's not based on what you and I might have been taught in religious learnings about how to treat other people as you want to be treated. And I think that they're part of what's going on now in exacerbating the hunger strike, and I don't really call it a hunger strike. These are self-starving, unlawful combatant Islamists who will do anything to try to affect the political will of the United States of America, and that's exactly what's happening. And unfortunately, our president has swallowed that hook, line, and sinker. In fact, I think he said in his speech that the detention facility at Guantanamo has, quote, become a symbol around the world for an America that flouts the rule of law. Mm. And that just really saddened me because it's so untrue. Guantanamo exists because of the law. Remember, Geneva Conventions are rules for war to protect innocent people and property. And there has to be a consequence for breaking the rules. Not one of those people who have ever been at Guantanamo Bay, and remember, Daria, there have been over 600 released, none of them executed, none of them beheaded, none of them hacked to death, all with the same number of fingers and toes that they came to Gitmo with. Some didn't have some of their digits because they were blown off or what have you. But 600 plus have been released. And to say that it's a symbol around the world for America that flouts the rule of law, it exists because of the law. In fact, if there weren't any legal backing for the existence of a military detention facility in wartime, it would never have happened, but it's because of the law that it exists. So, you know, that was really disappointing along with other things. I had a several-page response to the president's comments on my blog, which is simply savinggrace@guantanamobay.com. But that was really one of the things that kind of was like a sucker punch, you know, to have your own president kind of say that what's going on there isn't legal. Which is very far from the truth.
Yeah, it's sickening. It's sickening, and I won't even get started on him because I want to keep this about you. But let me just say that I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying, and I want you to talk about. And I know, you know, during back in the day, you know, from 2001 on, when Guantanamo opened, there were a lot of pundits in the alternative media who did write about what was truly going on and the way that these combatants treated people like you that were guarding them. And yet they were given their prayer mats and their, you know, you had to handle it. I read somewhere that you and others who were there on behalf of the United States had to wear gloves and handle the Quran with them and, you know, treat it with all this respect. And yet you were treated savagely. Can you talk a little bit about that? Describe what that was like?
The detainees would, and they still do, by media reports, and I'm shocked that the media actually reports this, but they threw what we call the Gitmo cocktail on the guards, which is a combination of urine, feces, and whatever else the detainee can come up with, and splash a guard as they walk by or come to them. But also at Gitmo, we had a rash of what I call in my book sucker punching. In other words, when a detainee had to come out of their cell, which was quite frequently, they were told to assume the position, which is their back to the door of the cell, with their hands behind their head, on their knees, with their head down. In this instance, when the guard comes in with the shackles, is the most risky part of dealing with the detainees. And occasionally, some of them would just turn around and punch the guard as they were vulnerably reaching for their arms to put the shackles on. And it just spoke to, especially in the beginning, Daria, the extreme danger that we all felt around them, because we knew that these guys from about 24 countries, speaking about 24 languages, there were only about 250 of them to begin with. These guys were mercenaries. These are soldiers of fortune, not necessarily Taliban or Al-Qaeda. They're just guys that really enjoy killing other people. And we're willing to do it either for drugs or for money. And they love to fight. They love to get into it. David Hicks, the Australian, is a famous example. I read about him a couple of times in the book for being violent. He was told to me that as soon as he got off of the plane that took him there, he promised to kill an American before he left Guantanamo Bay. Of course, he didn't. But these are the types of personalities. And since we captured one of their training manuals, and that was passed around to us while we were working there to read and to study, there's a whole chapter on how to behave if you're detained. And there's several entries about how to lie about your treatment, what to ask for. Ask for a lawyer, ask for your rights, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Don Rumsfeld, in his biography, Known and Unknown, he has several really good sections on Guantanamo. He basically says that Guantanamo was picked. One of the reasons it was picked was because it was offshore. So it would give them time to figure out what to do with these guys, because they knew that lawfare would be perpetrated upon us. And lawfare is like warfare, except using the law. And because the United States has such a liberal legal system, in other words, we'd rather let a guilty person free than convict an innocent person, for the most part, our enemies felt that they could manipulate the American legal system, which they actually were successful in doing. In fact, the Military Commissions Act, which governs military commissions at Gitmo now, the act that was finally passed in 2009, really give detainees who are charged with war crimes the identical rights that you or I would have, Daria, in a federal court of law. They're presumed innocent. The conviction standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, et cetera, et cetera. So it makes it very, very difficult to convict someone using those high standards. Now, why wouldn't we want to use those high standards? The reason why is, again, they were caught on the battlefield as unlawful combatants. They weren't following the rules of the Geneva Conventions and the law of land warfare. And there has to be a consequence. And the consequence historically has been they earn no extra legal privileges. And that means they're not supposed to be treated like you and I would be treated in a federal court of law. They haven't earned that. And people like to talk about rights. Well, rights can't exist without responsibilities. And it's just as if you and I were playing a game, call it chess, and I wanted to pretend that two of my pieces could move like a queen. Well, it wouldn't be very fun, and we wouldn't get very far, and the game is bastardized. So not to try to, you know, make a connection with a game and the global war on terror, but it's a very simple concept. If you don't follow the rules, you don't get the benefit. And what has over time, this government, through Department of Justice, our president, and these attempts by outside attorneys from other countries and even our own, perpetrate lawfare on the situation to get these detainees as much rights as you and I have as United States citizens.
That's just sickening to me. Absolutely disgusting. And I have to say, Monty, one time I was listening, I think it was Judge Napolitano, and this is where I have a real problem with libertarians, because he was making this argument that somehow prisoners in Gitmo were entitled to the same rights under the United States Constitution. And I thought to myself, under what universe? They're not in uniform. They're not American citizens. They want to kill us. What don't you understand about that? And so I just, it's just stunning to me. It really is. You know, Stalin had a term, useful idiots, to describe people who fell for his propaganda. And we have our useful idiots, unfortunately, in this country. And I take particular issue with any American attorney or lawyer who takes up the case for a jihadist. I just do. So go ahead. Let me let you back in here.
I agree with you 100%. And I've been on these TV shows and radio shows with these folks as well. I think it's an abomination. I don't think they have any right to defend these people in such a way. And I think it cheapens our rights as lawful U.S. citizens when unlawful combatants are given the same protections as you and I. And it's absolutely true. The Supreme Court has ruled against allowing the detainees that are accused of war crimes having habeas corpus rights, and then they've ruled for them to have these rights. And it's kind of solidified in the Military Commissions Act of 2009. When I tell people that, they have the same reaction that you have. How could this possibly be true? But this is the effect of lawfare. This is the effect that Don Rumsfeld knew was coming even before Gitmo opened. He knew that this was going to happen. So the initial Military Commissions Act, which he gathered a who's who of legal celebrities, for lack of a better term, both from conservative and liberal sides of the fence, and he had them write the first modern Military Commissions Act. And one of these folks was even in on the Nuremberg trials, which took place after World War II, that convicted German war criminals. So that he had this huge, impressive brain trust come up with rules about trying detainees who are accused of war crimes. Now, most of them aren't accused of war crimes. And during World War II, Derry, we held over 400,000 lawful combatants, prisoners of war from Germany and Italy in this country without one call for extra legal privileges for them. And in fact, during World War II, you may have heard of this, 8 dry-foot German saboteurs were captured, some in Florida, some here on Long Island. And within 4 weeks, 6 had been convicted and executed. And the president at that time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had gone to the Supreme Court and said, hey, should we have military commissions? And they said, well, of course you should. Should they have habeas corpus rights? Well, we're at war, so of course they don't get the same rights that you and I would have. They weren't in uniform. They weren't carrying arms openly. We found the plans. We got 2 of them to flip on the other 6. Have the military commission, and there's some punishment for this. And it was electrocution. So within 4 weeks, we had captured, tried, convicted, and executed 6 of 8 German saboteurs who meant us harm. They actually didn't kill anyone. They didn't blow anything up. But they were tried and convicted according to our laws, according to international law. And yet now, when we have evidence on some of these guys, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and some others, that they have planned and helped carry out some of the most heinous atrocities in modern times, and yet they're still there because of this legal wrangling that continues to go on to this day.
Well, I think it's also a result of, you know, we, especially in the last 50 years of just progressive indoctrination and, you know, where the world is just completely flipped. Right is wrong, good is bad, you know, it's all about this moral relativism, and it's killing us. I think that the West is committing suicide. And, you know, you mentioned, well, a couple of things you mentioned earlier, Monty, that I want to ask you about. You know, I think you said there were 600 that have been released from Gitmo since it opened.
I believe it's 602.
What
there.
Is the attrition rate with these people? I mean, tell us about what happens after they're released, because haven't many of them gone back out on the battlefield and gone on to kill American soldiers or other soldiers who are aligned with us in this fight against, you know, the jihad?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And I like to tweet this point as well when I get people who are arguing that, oh, they're innocent, they haven't done anything. First of all, they're not innocent or guilty of anything, most of them. Because they don't have to be. Geneva Convention allow us to hold even lawful combatant POWs without charge until, quote, the end of hostilities. So why then have we released 602? Because we don't have to. But the Office of the Director of National Intelligence did a study that was released September 2012. And it's not even a year old, that there's a 27% recidivism rate of former Gitmo detainees. That's 15.8% confirmed recidivists, which means those who've been caught doing something, and 12.1% suspected recidivists, means guys who pretty sure did something but haven't been caught and retrieved. So that's a total of almost 28% recidivism rate. One of these is a man by the name of Ben Kumu, Q-U-M-U, who is suspected of leading the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. So these, to me, if you're going to capture 400,000 Germans and Italians during World War II who are lawful combatants, and you're going to hold them until hostilities are over, and you're going to capture thousands of lawful combatant Iraqi soldiers and hold them during the first Gulf War and not release one of them until the conflict is done, why on earth will we let unlawful combatants go, especially now knowing that over a fourth of them are most probably going to go back to their Islamist ways? It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. It absolutely does. And it's just, again, it's one of those things that makes me want to pull my hair out. And, you know, we just had this incident, and you mentioned it, and I want you to talk about this too. You know, that the poor soldier in England who was hacked to death, and how brave. And I think the thing that scared me the most about that, aside from being just absolutely horrified and just shocked by, well, I can't say I was shocked because you expect this kind of behavior, but just this poor man, just imagining this horrific assault and how they killed him. But they're out on the street corners waving at people going by on buses. They're with their bloody hands and knives and bragging about it. And yet in England they're being told, oh, you can't say anything bad about Islam. This isn't about the Muslim religion. It's just absolutely, again, I cannot believe how the West is committing suicide. It's my friend Risa Kirkland, Warchick, on Twitter. She calls it political castration, and she's absolutely right. I mean, it's like we don't have the moral chutzpah to stand our ground and say, yeah, our culture is superior to this, and we're going to fight for it. It seems to be just the opposite. We're kind of assisting them in our demise.
Yeah, I agree, unfortunately. Sometimes when I tweet with people, they point out that when the United States interned Japanese Americans during World War II, that was morally wrong. And you can go back and forth on the moral question all you want. But what we know from our history is that if there's a war going on, the longer the war goes on, the less right and wrong matter. And I'm not saying that to indict us or indict anyone, but in the end, you win if you focus on winning. And sometimes you do what's necessary to survive, Abraham Lincoln once said, it is better to cut off the gangrenous arm, and he was talking about the Constitution, to save the body, meaning the Union. So even Lincoln, when he suspended habeas corpus for U.S. citizens and created military commissions for U.S. citizens, even he knew, and you can tell from his pick of U.S. Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, and William Tecumseh Sherman, who sort of invented the term total war, where you just go in and burn the city, he knew that he could not win with the traditional general, and he could not win with traditional ways, that to preserve the Union, he had to pull out all the stops and do what it took to win. But he did it legally. He was vilified for it at the time. But the reason why was the Southern spies were literally almost turning the tide of the war in the Confederate favor. So they had to come up with a way, and in fact that is written into the Constitution, that the president may suspend habeas corpus in time of invasion. So, you know, we have a history of surviving wars. We've beaten Islamists twice in the two Barbary Wars that we had right after our country's birth, where the Barbary pirates were Islamists, were capturing just about everybody's ships, the captured Marines of ours, etc. And the world got together and decided, you know what, piracy is a bad thing. Let's pool all of our resources, build the biggest, fastest, strongest, best ships in the world, and go get them. And that's basically what they did. And I think when we started Operation Iraqi Freedom, after Enduring Freedom, that we were going to get the pirates. And I think what President Obama did was throw Iraq to the wolves, and he created a security vacuum, as we see that is now the bad guys are coming home to roost. Hundreds of innocent Iraqis have been murdered this month alone with their bombings. Our new Secretary of State Kerry was there, I believe, last month, almost begging the Iraqis to stop letting the Iranians fly supply missions into Syria to help Assad. So why are we still in countries 67 years after World War II, like Germany, Japan, and Italy, countries we defeated in World War II, why do we still have bases there? Why do we still have troops in those countries in 70 countries around the world? It's because we need these power projection platforms to support our clandestine operations, our special forces guy, our CIA guys. We need to be close to where the enemy is to kill them or capture them. And the only way we can turn this tide and win it like we did the Barbary Wars is cooperations with our allies, but also keep the high ground, as it were. Iraq was the high ground, and we gave it up.
Yeah.
And any military person you'll ever talk to say that it was just a foolish thing to do. And it's coming home to roost.
Yeah, and Monty, it breaks my heart, too, when I think of all the men and women in uniform who died or were gravely injured in the effort to secure and stabilize that country, too. I mean, it's like all of that effort, all that blood and treasure now is just in vain. It's for nothing. But I want to ask you about another aspect of all of this, and that's like, I've always, and I'll just speak for myself here, I've been of the opinion, you know, protect and defend American interests at all costs. An act of war, is, you know, such as 9/11, that's a clear act of war to me. I don't make any moral equivocation with that. I do, and I want you as a member of the military to speak to this. I have a problem sometimes with the nation building and this notion that everybody's like, you know, like Western civilizations or like Americans where they're capable of even, or that it's even our job to really help them create a democracy. I mean, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, this whole campaign about winning hearts and minds, to me, our military should be focused on killing bad guys and protecting Americans and doing their best to keep themselves protected.
You're right.
But what are your thoughts on that?
No, you're right. But let's look at the Marshall Plan. Let's look at what happened to Europe after World War II. Did we perpetrate an occupation on Germany? Yes, we shared that responsibility, though. There were different zones for other countries, Russia and Great Britain. And we made deals with the governments. We said, look, we'll give you all this infrastructure, rebuilding money and material and make business relationships. And here's the key thing, Daria. But in your new constitution, and include Germany and Japan, Italy in this, we insist that you write that you may only spend 1% or less of your gross national product on defense. So what, in effect, we did was subsidize their defense. Imagine if we only spent 1% of our GNP on defense.
We'd be in the dark ages.
What wonderful things you could do with your infrastructure, with your research and development, your space program, you know, helping people be successful in life. I mean, all those resources. So that's sort of fading away now. But look at Europe. They've been at peace since the end of World War II. Why have they been at peace? Because we've been there. That's why.
Right.
And I understand that there's you know, a PR problem with us, quote unquote, remaining in some of the Arab countries or other countries that we've gone into. And that's a perception problem that we can only solve if we're there. People will only respect and like Americans if they deal with respectable and likable Americans. Can it be military people? Of course. I was in Baghdad, Iraq, for a month at the headquarters, and was assigned temporarily to the logistics department. And back then the rules were, no matter what you've heard or read, that all the aid money had to be given to local vendors. The only thing that the American vendors did was help Americans stay alive logistically on our bases. Anything else, and sometimes even what happened in the bases, you had to get an outside contractor. So that's what the logistics department did. They went out and they contracted with local Iraqi businesses, and they made friendships. But what happens if they get word that you're not going to stay very long? What happens if they get the word that, in fact, you're leaving? You destroy that friendship. You destroy that relationship. You destroy that trust. And that has happened time and again in the modern times, after World War II, or after Korea, because we are still in South Korea. And the reason South Korea is free and at peace and very prosperous is because we're there. And we're not there as occupiers. We're there as friends. You can't get a better friend than the United States of America. And I think what we're trying to tell the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, although our president kind of gets in the way, is you don't have a worse enemy than the United States of America either. You want to be friends with us. And it's not that we want to come in there and control you. We don't control France. We don't control the United Kingdom or Italy or any of the countries that we have bases in. We're there because we're friends. We share a philosophy, morals and ethics with them. And they're willing to let us do what we need to do to help keep the world safe. And indeed, 37 came in as coalition partners with boots on the ground in Iraq. Over 48 came in to Afghanistan. So it really is a coalition. I think the liberal press want to make it out to be that we've done these things unilaterally, but we've done none of it unilaterally. But we need to... Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, I definitely understand everything you said and agree with you. The other point, though, I guess I wanted to make, too, is do you feel, though, with the Hearts and Minds campaign, that you as the military have been restricted, sort of had to fight this battle, like with one arm tied behind your back because the rules of engagement against these terrorists? I'm not talking about other peaceful members of the population, but, you know, the rules of engagement that have been imposed with respect to hunting down and killing these terrorists. Have you felt restricted by that?
Yeah. And I think part of it is, again, and I know some really good attorneys who are really nice people and they're friends of mine involved in something, and they'll find a reason to get them to stay involved. And over time, the rules of engagement, which for your non-military listeners is known as the ROE, and it's a legal document. It's classified. We're not supposed to talk about details of it, but it gives you the rules that you have to live and fight and die by. And, yes, they have become more restrictive. They don't allow you the opportunity to be proactive. And we all know the best defense is an active offense. So when we are proactive, we, in effect, don't follow the laws of war or Geneva Conventions either. We go out there without uniforms, without rank, without identification on our clandestine operators, our CIA operatives, our special forces, and we do things we know we have to do to keep us safe. And it goes back to Lincoln's comment about severing the arm to save the body. We are fighting a war of survival. Because if you have a Boston Marathon every weekend, if you have a hacking every other day, we're not free. We're not experiencing liberty. So we have to do what's necessary to protect our interests. And that the rules of engagement obviously need to change. They need to change to give us the advantage on the battlefield. Why do we want to make things equal with the enemy? It doesn't make any sense, Daria, rules or laws that give them the same rights that we have, even though they're breaking the rules every step of the way. You don't make rules to favor the enemy. You take away the enemy's will and means to fight. And you do that, yes, by gaining hearts and minds, but how do you do that? It's a civilian thing. It's a military thing. I mean, the military officers that you have in this all-volunteer military are some of the finest human beings you ever want to meet in your entire life. They're smart, professional. They're fair-minded. They make friends easily. Military officers make friends easily with those they interact with. And they're very, because of these values that we hold so dear, the loyalty, the duty, the respect, the honor, the integrity, the personal courage, all these things you find in every single military officer. So we are very good PR people to outreach to people in these countries where the Islamists want to take control. So I see it as a civil military operation to win hearts and minds. But you have to be there. You have to make a commitment. And they can't perceive that you're just going to not be there next week. It's
right.
the opposite message you want to send. And I think that's why President Obama is sending the exact opposite message by leaving Iraq, by saying we're going to leave Afghanistan. Afghanistan is poised to be the leader of democracy in that region. If only we can stay long enough to help them realize it and then maintain bases there so that we can have some power projection and protect our operators when they go off and do these missions to help protect us.
Right. God, Monty, I'm so glad. I mean, I'm so glad you're able to join me today to clarify so much of this. I mean, it's just so important to get this out there so that to help try to get Americans to understand, you know, what's really going on. And I can't believe that we only have a few minutes left. I definitely want to bring you back again. And perhaps we'll talk offline about another network I'm going to be involved with. Because
sure.
I just feel like it's important to really highlight these issues. But before we go ahead and tell us where people can find your book and your blog and anything else you might want to add that we haven't discussed today.
Sure. My book, you can find it on Amazon. It's in hardback. It's in a newer edition where I added about 14 pages of information and comments. It was put out last spring. It's a soft cover version. And you can get it on Kindle. You can get it on Nook and also at Barnes & Noble. But the my author website is sbpra.com/Montgomery J. Granger. That's sbpra.com at Montgomery J. Granger. And my blog, which I don't update very often, but I just did, is savinggraceatguantanamobay.com. And it's just been a pleasure. I'm so grateful for your kindness and your support and this opportunity to speak with you and your listeners.
Oh, Monty, I'm very proud to know you. And again, thank you just for your service and for everything you do, you've done and continue to do for the cause of freedom. And it's my pleasure. And I just want to mention also that people, if you're on Twitter, you can follow Monty at MJGranger1. So be sure and do that. And, God, Monty, there was something else I wanted to ask you, and it just went right out of my head. Oh, just quickly, what has been the reaction to your book, to Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay?
It's been building. You know, my publisher is not one of those big box publishers, so a lot of the marketing is up to me. And I've been on Twitter for almost 2 years now and have about 20,000 followers. But those are quality followers. I'd say about 70 to 80% of them are military folks that are so generous. They retweet things for me. They buy my book. They give me great feedback on it. So it's been doing, actually gathering a little bit of momentum. And I think that's good because it has some, like you've mentioned, it has some information in there that the mainstream media will not tell you.
Yeah. Absolutely. So mainly you use social media then as far as promotion?
Pretty much, and the occasional radio show. I've done HuffPost Live 3 times. I've done a British TV show. I've done an American TV show, and occasionally I tweet the links to those. But they're also available on my publisher's website. And there's also, they do a Facebook page for me, Montgomery Granger. And so all these things are put out there, and I hope people are interested in the topic and want to keep Gitmo open, because it is the best place for unlawful combatant Islamists who want to kill us.
Yep. Amen to that. Well, Monty, God bless you, and thank you again for joining me today, and I will definitely see you on Twitter.
Absolutely. Thanks, Daria. God bless.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Montgomery J. Granger, who I was told I could call Monty. Please check out his book, Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay, A Memoir of a Citizen Warrior. Gosh, he was full of so much excellent information today. I hated to even have to end our interview, so I will definitely be bringing him back on the program, as well as hopefully recruiting him for another network that I'm going to be involved in. So please follow him at MJGranger1 on Twitter. Check out Montgomery J. Granger on Facebook and read his blog, Saving Grace at Guantanamo Bay. .com. We're going to take a short break, and in the second half of the program, I should be back with author Catherine McNamara. Hopefully, she's calling in from Italy, so I'm praying that there won't be any technical difficulties. So be back here shortly, hopefully, with author Catherine McNamara. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Imagine a world where bullying isn't considered a normal part of childhood.
A world where I'm not afraid to go to school.
To speak out.
To be myself.
A world where I'm not afraid to be caught alone.
Come on, Punk. We have the power to stop the bullying.
Speak out.
Speak up.
Educate.
Find out what to look for and how you can make a difference at bullying.org.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up.
I shouldn't be afraid to get on the school bus.
To turn on my computer.
A walk to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Where you're not alone.
Where you're not alone.
I'll never get used to these 10-mile runs. They are taking so much time out of my day.
Are you training for a marathon or something?
Diabetes runs in my family, and I heard if you lose lots of weight, you can prevent it. So I started running like crazy, and I cut my calories big time.
Oh, get real. You don't have to knock yourself out to prevent diabetes. My doctor said it's the small lifestyle changes you make that matter, because it's easier to stick to them.
Wow, really?
It worked for me. 6 months ago, I started walking a lot and I stopped eating the fried stuff. I've lost 10 pounds. My doctor said I'm doing great.
I'll have to ask my doctor about this. I'd love to get my life back.
Talk to your healthcare provider. Losing a small amount of weight by being active 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and eating healthier can prevent type 2 diabetes. To get your free game plan for preventing type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the RightStream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talent to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense and global terrorism. RightStream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics. We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, we welcome your calls at 347-945-7246. And of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday RightStream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag RightStream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the RightStream Radio Network and the RightStream Twitter chat.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Daria Ann, on RightStream Tuesday. Just waiting here for a few moments for author Catherine McNamara to call in. So while I'm waiting for that, let me tell you a little bit about her. She is a prolific author and blogger, and she's going to talk to us today about her book, The Divorced Lady's Companion to Living in Italy, and also her forthcoming collection of short stories entitled Pelt and Other Stories, her thoughts on the writing and publishing process, and her insights on social media and other marketing venues for authors. You know, we live in an age of new media, which is phenomenal, and I always love to talk to my authors about, you know, what they do, what platforms they use, what's been most effective for them in connecting with their audience and really engaging that readership. And not only selling books, but really building relationships with the people who support them in their work. But here's a bit about Catherine in her own words. She says, I write commercial and literary fiction, novels, and short stories. My women's commercial novel, The Divorced Lady's Companion to Living in Italy, was published on April 16, 2012 by Indigo Dreams Publishing, UK. My book of short stories, Pelt and Other Stories, is coming out in 2013 with IDP. It was semi-finalist in the 2011 Hudson Prize USA. I am a crew member of ViewFromHereMagazine.com, judged as one of the 10 best literary magazines by The Writing Magazine in January of 2012. So I'm hoping that she will get on the line here. And I'm still waiting. She's calling in from Italy. I don't know if the code is any different. Apparently, there was an issue with Skype. So hopefully, she'll be calling in here momentarily. But for anyone who may be listening for the first time, I'll tell you a little bit about me while we're waiting. Again, I'm an independent author. I wrote a book called Water Signs, A Story of Love and Renewal back in 2008. It's a fictionalized version of some real-life events that transpired between the years 1992 and 2008. We're currently working on a sequel to that. Definitely my books contain themes of patriotism and love of country, family, conflict, resolving conflict, personal growth, spiritual development, things that are relatable to the human experience. And I've, you know, it's always music to every author's ears when someone tells you, you know, I couldn't stop turning the pages or I couldn't put your book down. And so I was blessed to have reactions like that in 2008 when I self-published my book. And since then, technology has even advanced, so much more than it was even back then. And I'm currently working on my sequel. Enough about me because, yay, I think I've got Catherine McNamara on the line. So I am so excited. Again, she is a prolific writer and blogger. I read you her intro. But her book is called The Divorced Lady's Companion to Living in Italy. And she has a forthcoming collection of short stories entitled Pelts and Other Stories. So we're going to be discussing both of those, as well as her thoughts on the writing and publishing process and her insights on social media and other marketing venues for authors and writers. So ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I welcome Catherine McNamara to WriteStream Tuesday. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. I'm so glad you're able to call in. How are you?
That's good. I'm very glad. I was a bit sort of, apprehensive. I'm fine, thank you. Very well. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, my gosh. It's my pleasure. So why don't I give you an opportunity, Catherine, to introduce yourself. I read a little bit from your blog, from the bio that you have there, but introduce yourself in your own words, and then we'll start talking, and we'll get into some good topics about your book and some other issues having to do with writing.
Okay. I'm Australian. I was born in Sydney, grew up in Sydney, and left very early because I was very restless and I was in love with Paris. So I lived in Paris for quite a while. I began writing short stories and publishing short stories. And then, although it wasn't really planned, I ended up getting married and going to Africa. And I spent a long time in Somalia, quite a long time ago, and then later on in Ghana. And I've spent a few years back in Europe in between, and I've been in Italy now for 10 years. And in that time, I've had children, written this book, written some other books that haven't been published, and I've published a lot of short stories. And, the past couple of years have really been devoted to publicizing The Divorced Lady and then, collating these short stories and trying to get more and more published. So that's me.
So, you've been a busy lady, Catherine. So tell us about, or let's start with The Divorced Lady. Tell us about that and how, I guess I'm sure it correlates to your reasons for moving to Italy. So let's talk a little bit about that and how did it get started?
Well, it started because I was very tired of another book that I was in the middle of, which was quite sort of big and literary and depressing and hard work. It's very hard to get anything literary published at the moment. And a friend said to me, why don't you write something about Italy? And I'd never even considered writing about Italy because Italy is where you live, where your kids go to school, I mean, where you go shopping. And to me, it was just, you know, the place where I live, the place I enjoy. I didn't look at it as a sort of, you know, a source of writing material. I'd always thought of Africa because people love reading about Africa. But I actually went home that day and I set myself up in the chicken shed behind my house. I live in a big house in the country. It was during, you know, kids' summer holidays, so very, very, very hot. And I sat there and I wrote every single morning for, the rest of the school holidays until it was too cold. And I finished my first draft, and I wanted to express, not really my own feelings about being divorced, because obviously I am. I mean, not obviously, but I am. But really to talk about Italy and talk about being a woman in her 40s and try and find the funny aspects of Italian culture, how they clash with the aspects of sort of Anglo culture, because Australian, English, American, they all share same language and often, many things, and bring it all together. And I don't know, I had a very good time writing the story. I laughed and laughed and laughed. It's funny, really. So it was really an exploration of, and a reaction to writing serious stuff and needing to get away from that and have fun, really, and also see if it would work, because I hadn't really written comedy before.
Sure. Sure. So what are some of the biggest differences, Kevin? Obviously, the language is probably the most important thing. I mean, what was that like? What kind of an adjustment was that for you, you know, as a person who speaks English, you know, to live in Italy? And what are some of the funny things that you point out, you know, funny differences between the cultures that you point out in your book?
Oh, it's full of them, because I spend half my life writing, laughing about them here. I mean, I've been speaking Italian for a long time, and I understand the dialect in my area, which is the Northeast, it's the Veneto area. And attitudes towards women, family, children, dressing, sexuality, marriage, cooking, I mean, they're very different here. It's very Italian, it's very traditional in a way. I mean, obviously there's a lot of modern things happening here too, but I think a lot of roles have remained quite traditional here, especially, well, in particular, I was interested in the role of the older woman and how an older woman, maybe with, you know, coming from outside, sort of can clash with, you know, the attitude of men to women here and the role of being a mother, and then a woman's sexuality sort of fading a little bit as she gets to 40. And, well, the woman, the protagonist of my book, gets herself into a lot of very funny situations.
Then what has the reaction been like to your book?
Well, anybody who lives in Italy laughs and laughs and laughs. And anybody who even has a sort of basic knowledge of how women are looked at in this country, if you're a traveler or if you're, you know, living here, making your life here, women are sort of stared at. I mean, people are very conscious of what other people are wearing, I think, a lot more than in other countries. And so that's the first thing you notice when I think you're a female walking around here. So, and, well, just basic cultural attitudes, I think, that has made a lot of people laugh, thank goodness. And English people, too, it's had a good sort of reaction in England, and most of my blog hits are really American, so I'm glad somebody in America is laughing, too.
Now, Catherine, I was going to say, I mean, you know, it's funny, I mean, I know we had talked about this in our email correspondence, I mean, in spite of my name, and you know, which obviously talks, you know, when you hear my name, you know that my descent is from, you know, from Italy or from an Italian line. But you know, my great grandparents on my mom's side came here, you know, that were born here, and my dad, I guess his parents were they were like 19 or 20 when they came. But you know, for all intents and purposes, I am an American. If I would be in the same situation as you, if I found myself in Italy, you know, trying to adjust, because it, you know, I wouldn't really have much in common other than, okay, a familiar sounding name. So that's one of the reasons why I was so excited to talk to you today, just to kind of find out how you made that adjustment too.
I don't think I've fully made that adjustment. I think there are certain things here that drive me absolutely crazy, really, really crazy. And I have a very different sense of humor to Italian people. Italian people, it's sort of, you know, they tell policeman jokes and things like that. It can be very sexual, very crude. It's not sort of really refined humor, English humor, which is often, you know, about a play on words or things like that. I go nuts the way people drive here, the way people take themselves so seriously. I mean, their look is very, very important. I think Americans also are a lot more relaxed about, you know, who they are, how they look on the street. They don't really care. Well, you know, not to, you don't have to be dressed in designer clothes every time you walk out the door. So
right.
I think,
oh, so it's like that there. That's interesting. People are very hung up on labels
on.
And
I mean, it's something I like, too. I love the fashion in Italy. I'm in love with shoes. I'm in love with handbags. I mean, I'm also a girly girl, and I love that aspect here. There's beautiful clothes and beautiful leather. I mean, obviously, that's all gorgeous here. And it's accessible. It's not all expensive, I think. But being obsessed with it and being, okay, there's a great big wave of plastic surgery, too, here. That's the same everywhere in the world. But I think a lot of people have fallen into that sort of hole here too. Women can be very insecure, I think, but that's a global thing. I don't think that's particular to Italy. But if you look at Italian women in politics, they are all desperate to look like, you know, women who are 32 and 28 when maybe they're pushing 50. So I think there's a lot of insecurity with women here.
Yeah, and I think that's a very sad aspect of our culture. And I'll say this as an American. I think in the United States, it kind of depends on where you go. I think it's affected the country as a whole, what you're saying. But it's also more extreme in certain areas. And I live in South Florida, and believe me, there's way too much emphasis
I'm sure.
on way too much emphasis on physical looks. And I'm all about, I'm like you, I'm a girly girl. I'm all about, you know, looking your best and putting your best foot forward. I mean, my mother, once I was old enough to wear makeup, if I left the house without lipstick, I heard about it from my mom. You know, where's your lipstick? Put lipstick on. But just as you're saying, I mean, anything taken to an extreme can become a bad thing. And I really, it's very interesting to hear you talk about that, because I didn't realize that was such an issue, such a problem in Italy, or such a reality, I guess I should say, that people are.
It's a reality. I don't think you, well, you mightn't want to bother, though, but Italian television is extremely, it's where you see it all happening. I mean, it's because of the past government. Okay, now Italy's political situation is quite confusing. I mean, it always is, but I mean, we've had a long. A long experience with Berlusconi, who's had a lot of influence upon what is shown on the television. And his, well, the women that you see on television are all, you know, Amazonian 20-year-olds who nobody can aspire to look like. And it's a very bad example, I think, if you're raising a daughter. It's really unrealistic. And, well, crazy things have happened in politics, but I don't really want to talk about politics at all. Right. But a lot of, yeah, women who are not women. Setting bad example for all of us normal people.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's sad that we seem to have lost the concept, and I think in the world at large, you know, in general, we seem to have lost the concept of aging gracefully and still looking your best no matter your age. But, you know, aging gracefully and understanding, you know, looking great at 50 is going to be different from looking great at 20.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's part of the thing I really had a good time talking about in the book, because the woman who goes through the various things that she does go through when she comes to Italy, meaning finding, you know, a young lover, an older lover, and she is a mother of teenagers, as I am, and her body's obviously changed. And her idea of beauty is, she does get is sort of enticed by the whole Italian thing, you know, I want to be womanly and curvy and dressed well and everything. But at the end of the day, well, I can't tell you what happens, but at the end of the day, I mean, real love has wrinkles, and real love gets old, and real love is saggy, and real love is really beautiful that way anyway. So, well, you'll just have to see what happens in the book. But I did want to show that real love is not, it's not false, and it doesn't have to be young. I mean, and the way to grow old, you know, gracefully is with humor, I think, and with looking at yourself and appreciating yourself for what you are and what you've achieved, or, you know, what you've missed out on. It doesn't really matter.
Oh, I agree with you 100%, Catherine. Now, where can we get your book? Where is it available for anybody that wants to purchase it?
Well, the easiest way from the U.S. is on Amazon. It's on Amazon as an e-book or, you know, hard copy, whichever is easier, really. It's only in independent bookshops, really, in England, or there's some places in Italy that stock it, but I think the best way to get it is online. Or you can order it directly from my publisher. My publisher's called Indigo Dreams. And it's all, well, it's all easy to find online.
Excellent. Yeah, and I have to say, and I want to get into this topic as well, I think new media has been such a blessing for authors. Well, I mean, and like everything else, it has its disadvantages. But what are your thoughts on that? And let's delve into that a little bit.
Well, I don't have a Kindle or an e-reader or anything like that. I don't go to bookshops very often because I live in the countryside and I really like well-equipped, independently-minded bookshops, and so I wait till I go to the UK to do all my book hunting. But otherwise, I love ordering stuff online. I read a good review and I'll order the book straight away, and I get a package on my gatepost and I get very excited, so I think I'm a bit old-fashioned with all of that. I love the internet and I love the work possibilities. I mean, I met you this way. The work possibilities are endless, which is fantastic, because I used to feel the writing life, the isolation was, well, it can be very hard, very depressing. I mean, you need to have so much patience waiting for replies. Now everything has speeded up quite a bit. You get your email straight away, you get a rejection straight away, or you get an acceptance almost straight away. I think the time required to wait has sort of lessened, and that means less pressure as a writer, less risk of depression, and, you know, your work actually happens a lot faster. I think
that is so true, and it can be very isolating being a writer. And I think the benefit of social media is, from the marketing perspective, you can really get out there. Just as you and I met, you know, whether it's Twitter or Facebook, I happen to love Twitter, and there's a huge writers community on there. But you can connect with other writers and learn from each other, support each other. And I think that's such a benefit. On the flip side, at least for me, and I want to get your take on this, I have to be very, very disciplined, too, because when it's time to write and it's time to sit at your computer and write, it's time to write. And so it can be very difficult to sort of walk away from those social aspects, too, because it's more fun to chat away on Twitter than it might be to, you know, finish this next chapter you're working on. So how do you cope with that?
It's so true. I think discipline and time organization is just so critical now, because there are so many temptations out there. And you if you're doing a lot of promotion for a book, which everybody has to do now, you feel guilty if you're not doing your utmost to get word out, if you're not looking for more interviews, if you're not looking for more reviews, if you're not writing back to people who've been kind enough, you know, to show support. So I think it's bad. It puts me under a lot of pressure sometimes, and I really do have to tear myself away because I feel a work obligation. It's fun. I definitely agree. It's a lot of fun. But I think you can achieve so much in terms of, you know, these connections that you have to know when to stop. Sometimes I don't, actually. I think everybody's in the same boat. But for me, writing I'm doing short stories at the moment, and I'm revising a novel that I wrote a while ago, and I hate revising, and so I really have to push myself to do it. But writing new material, I love. That for me is luxury. And I'll run away and do that, but I can only do that when, well, my family's gone away.
Now, so, Catherine, tell us about your forthcoming collection of short stories. I know that's coming out this year, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's coming out in September, I think. I'm with a small publisher, so things either happen really quickly or really slowly. It depends on what else is in-house or what else is happening at the moment. I'm really excited about this because my main sort of passion has always been short stories. I adore short stories. And there's about 20 pieces. Most of them are set in West Africa. I spent 10 years in Ghana before I came to Italy, and also some time in East Africa, but that was quite a long time ago. And a lot of the stories are quite personal, dealing with family breakup, culture clashes, sort of the difference between old cultures and modern cultures. And I don't only mean from Europe to Africa. I mean, you know, there are old, ancient parts of sort of African culture and Africans who are completely modernized. And the same with Europeans. I mean, new ideas and old ideas clashing. And migration, I'm very interested in migration and the changes that you undergo when you sort of get submerged by a new culture. And then life and death and sex, I mean, the usual, that's all. And I love language. The language is sort of quite out there. And most of the stories have been published in literary reviews. So I think I hope it does okay. It was a semi-finalist in the Hudson Prize. So it's a good U.S. competition in 2011. I think that was the year it was accepted. So it's taken a long time to sort of get it into print, but it's coming. I think the cover's just been approved, and I think it looks great. So, yeah, it's moving.
Well, fantastic. Well, we'll have to stay in touch, and when it is released, Catherine, I want to definitely bring you back to talk about it.
Oh, that would be great, because I think, I love American readers. I really love being able to speak English. I think those of us who write in English, we're very lucky, because there's a, you know, American way of thinking, American sort of readership, English the same, there's differences. There's a fantastic women's fiction festival that I go to in the south of Italy every year, and they bring along American agents and English agents and American editors and English editors. And I think it's fantastic, the contrast between ways of thinking and ways of moving in sort of the whole digital world of publishing, because everything is changing so quickly. And just getting access to this energy, different types of energy, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy. I really love speaking with American readers, because I have a few people who communicate with me through the blog, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, and again, it's another benefit of new technology, which is amazing. Now, Catherine, about your blog, let's talk about this, because I'd love to talk to other authors about what they do to market. And to me, a blog is another way to kind of reach out to engage your readership and really market yourself and your work. Do you blog every day? I mean, how important do you feel it is for authors and writers to maintain a blog?
I think it's pretty essential right now. I mean, as you know, I'm not very good with Twitter because I've got a very bad connection where I live, and I get very frustrated staying online for a long time, so I try to organize my online time. But a blog is, you extend your story, you extend your personality, and you make yourself accessible, or you make your persona accessible. Obviously, you don't tell everything about your life because it's usually boring anyway. But you add things to the person that you are, and it shouldn't only be promotional, I don't think, because people get sick of hearing about, you know, my book. My life, aspects of writing and sharing things with other people. I think the sharing aspect's fantastic because you can host people, interview people, and you just build up a community of readers. But you also build up, I think, genuine friendships, which is the best thing about it. I've met people who have, you know, flown through Venice, and I've met through blogging a bunch of people, Americans mostly or English people, and it just makes me feel less isolated as a writer and, I think, more grown as a person and more real. I think it's great. The connection's really, really good. So I think it's worth working on. I think it's pretty essential. But it's up to you. Some people write as writers, and they can only write as writers. Some people don't sort of blab so much. I'm a bit of a blabber, so I like sort of blabbing about Italy, or I have something to get off my chest, and so I'll talk about it on my blog. And I like to raise a laugh. I think laughing's fantastic. And so I'm happy if people share their views, particularly on Italy, and they have a laugh as well. I've got two blogs running, one for each book. So they're quite different in tone.
And what are they? So, because I'll put a link in the chat room.
Okay, the first one is connected to the Divorced Lady, and I think it's called The Divorced Lady's Companion to Italy, and it's a Blogspot blog. And that deals with writing in Italy, living in Italy, funny things about Italy, Italian politics, you know, picking cherries, buying shoes, everything. And the other one is called Pelt and Other Stories, blogspot.com. And that deals more with Africa, migration, short story writing, sort of festivals that I've been to, sort of about more about the experience of being a writer. It's a little bit more serious, I think. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other ones, it's got a bit more sort of spiciness, I think.
Well, I'm definitely going to check out both of them. And we have a lot in common, Captain. Everything you just said, I wholeheartedly agree with. And I think, you know, one thing that I found, I self-published in 2008, and I found that people were as interested in me, the author, as they were in the book, and also in understanding, you know, how the writing process worked and you know, different things that I did to promote the book. So tell us a little bit about what was the experience? I know we talked a little bit about when you were writing The Divorced Lady's Companion to Living in Italy, but just maybe in general too about the writing process. Are there certain disciplines that you adhere to that kind of help keep you in that flow of creativity? I mean, what advice do you have for other writers?
Well, for me, I know some people can write in bars and take their laptop or their notebook and sit down in a bar, but I can't do that at all. I need to know that I have 4 or 5 hours of time ahead of me and nobody's going to talk to me. And I don't care about food, I don't need coffee, I don't need anything, I just need absolute silence. And that's how I work. And obviously I need to have an idea the night before or the day before or something that's really been simmering away for quite some time. And then I just sit down and do it. I love it. I absolutely love having an idea bursting in my brain and just waiting for it to all, you know, get written. I think that for me is really exciting. And when it's a book, though, I don't do plans. I don't plan at all. The Divorced Ladies, I know that I wanted to laugh. I knew my first sentence. I knew my title. And I knew a couple of things that were going to happen structurally, but I really had fun because I didn't know what was going to happen. I know there's a great big discussion that you plan or everything comes off the top of your head. And I think with that book, it came off the top of my head. But I've got another book planned and I don't think it's going to be like that. I think it's going to need a bit more sort of structural planning before I get started. But for me, language is very important, and so my brain has to be completely free. It has to be, and you know, when you get onto that plane, when everything's crystal clear and the words just come, and so basically I try and do everything so that my brain is nice and clear and fresh. That means getting a good sleep, eating good food, lots of vegetables, and doing sport maybe the day before, if that makes sense. I think being physically sound is very important to being mentally sound. They've got to come together.
Definitely. I work out every day, and I love my Leslie Sansone DVDs, so I can definitely relate to what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I also, Catherine, when you were saying about, you know, not having a structure so much for your first book, it's so funny because I can relate to that too. And I think, sometimes people, I think, as writers get too hung up on, oh, I have to have an outline first, and I have to do...
Yeah.
I think that each project kind of has its own rules, and you don't really know until you get in there and start working on it. What do you think about that?
No, I think you have to take risks, and I think you have to throw yourself in there, just like you said. I think you have to throw yourself at the idea and then embrace the idea, and then wonderful things happen. If you're on the right sort of wavelength, I think the idea expands and it can take you along with it. And I think first draft, you have to go. You just have to let go and go. And then obviously editing's different and you do have to pick things apart and remodel them if they're not really working. Get a second opinion. Be prepared to be sort of shot down. But in the beginning, I think, you know, wallow in it. Go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's that flow of creativity that we love. You know, you mentioned editing, so I'm really glad you brought that up. Kat, so what are your what's your advice for either, you know, authors who are existing authors or people who are aspiring to be authors, they're working on a book? What's your advice in terms of the editorial process?
Well, I don't think I'm an expert. I mean, I still love reading what other people suggest and say and, you know, tell. I'm also still learning, so I don't think I'm a, you know, big expert or anything, but I can just tell you what I do believe. Editing is horrible, and I think for this book, for The Divorced Lady, I sent it out too early and to people who were too big, because I think it is a bit of a niche book in that it deals with, because a lot of this would fall into a chick lit category, and a lot of chick lit books deal with 30-year-old women. And they don't say what sort of... I don't read a lot of chick-lit books, but I've read a few, and some of them are fantastic, and some of them irritated me because they dealt with one particular generation. They didn't ever deal with, well, what happens when everything falls apart, because often things do fall apart, or what happens with an older woman, or what happens with a woman who has these messy teenagers that she has to fit into her new life. So that book... hang on, I'm trying to think what I was going back to. The editing. I had to be careful who I sent it to. And so I think your editing, once you get to the editing stage, you already have to know, well, what is this book's journey going to be? Am I going to send it to a big publisher, a smaller publisher? Am I going to self-publish? Is it going to be an online book? I think you already have to sort of begin thinking in marketing terms once you get to a second or third or fourth draft. And I got up, I put the alarm on and did a 5 o'clock sort of couple of months and did an hour and a half in the morning to do a really sort of cutting edit. And I remember I did that for one edit, but I've done so many edits, I don't even want to remember how many I did. And then I sent it out to a smaller publisher, I think, after 6 months. I let it sit there for 6 months, and it was taken quite quickly, so I was very lucky. Because I think this publisher had just started with fiction, because before that they'd been doing mainly magazines and poetry. So I think I got in at the right time. I think it's very, very, very hard to get a book published now, probably harder than ever. But the good thing is that there are many smaller publishers coming together, because everybody realizes that mainstream publishers are very confined by, you know, economic expectations. They're very confined in what they can actually publish, so it's quite restricted. And so it is much better to be working with a small publisher, I think, because you're not expected to sell millions, because that's almost impossible, and you get a bit more creative latitude, I think, if you end up working with people who are on the same wavelength as you are. But I think editing is crucial, and you just have to, I don't know, have a drink and get down and do it. It has to be done, and it has to be... Yeah. It'll never be enough. I learned so much editing this book. I worked with an editor for 6 months on and off, and there were some days I would have, he was working in France, I would have driven over there and strangled him. It was hard work. He was very exacting, which is it's a very good learning procedure, because I haven't studied writing. I haven't done, you know, my degree in writing or a master's in writing, anything like that. And I learned so much from working with this man who had more editing experience than I have. So editing is, there's so much to learn. And I think it's also about having a good ear and trusting your ear and reading, obviously, endlessly. You have to read so much in order to become a good editor of your own work, and not thinking that you know everything, because you don't.
That is so true. What you just said about reading other people's work. Yeah, I can't agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more on that. And I think, you know, when you're talking about the publishing industry, I think new media has also turned that whole paradigm upside down now, with these big
publishing companies, and it's if you're not a known quantity, they don't have the economic wherewithal to go with you. They're going to go for the celebrity, the big name celebrity, politician, whoever it is that they look at and see dollar signs, you know, where they see a monetary return immediately. But that's also an opportunity for us too, for writers and for a lot of these new publishing companies. So.
No, I think so. I think I got to somewhere in my 40s, and I had wanted to have published a novel by then, and I hadn't because I'd been so tied up with kids. I actually have four of them, so it, you know, does sort of tend to wear down your energy resources. But I turned around and said to myself, look, you're middle-aged, you're a white housewife, you don't belong to any sort of interesting cultural group, or you don't have any particular story, history, or otherwise to tell, so you're absolutely non-commercial. So you're going to have to work really, really hard to make somebody interested in you. Obviously, big publishing companies, they want somebody who's bright and young and, you know, special in the way that youth is. And I don't have that, so I have to, you know, had to really think of a good story. I mean, it all comes down to the story at the end of the day.
No, that's the truth. If you have a quality story to tell, that you're right. It does all come down to that. So now, I also, when you mentioned earlier, we were talking about, I'm old-fashioned like you. I mean, I prefer to hold a book in my hand. I like having a bookshelf filled with lots of books that I can mark up and highlight and write in the margins. But in terms of our audience, so we do have to be willing to, and as you have, make our books available in all formats because there are so many people who love Kindle. I guess I can understand why they do because, you know, especially if you're traveling, you can just take one little piece of equipment and have, gosh, virtually an unlimited amount of information on there, books, magazines, whatever. So I certainly see that point of view. But I had a difficult time, I'll be honest with you, back in 2008 thinking, I don't want to make it available in Kindle. But I think we have to get out of our way and understand that's the marketing aspect that I think a lot of writers struggle with.
No, as I said, I don't have one, but I did push for mine to be made available as an ebook as quickly as possible because it's cheaper for the reader, it's more accessible to the reader, as you say. People were telling me they were traveling to Italy, where could they get my book? And obviously it had to be available as an ebook. Nobody wants to carry around a book they might even read in because you read the book quite quickly. Even people who I know are non-readers have told me I couldn't wait to get to the end of it. So you can't really expect people to lug your book around when they're traveling, no. But see, I spend my whole day in front of a screen. Even my first draft, I do it on a screen now, and then I'm reading the newspaper on the iPad. At the end of the day, I don't want to see a screen. I would like to hold a book, and my eyes just prefer a different texture, I think, at the end of the day.
Oh, yes. I am so with you on that. Yeah, with someone looking at the computer screen all day, too. Yes, and I think our eyes, literally, I just think our eyes need a break, too, from the light coming through the computer. And, yeah, it's so true. Now, Catherine, do you do any writing in terms of, are you writing books full-time, or do you employ, I thought I saw on your blog where you were also sort of a content writer or a writer for, you know, business writer in terms of, you know, maybe writing copy or anything like that, or have you had that experience?
I do. At the moment, I'm doing translations. I do a lot of translations from Italian to English, and I've worked on books. And a really interesting project that I've been working on for a few years is doing the signage for trails over the mountain ranges, really where parts of the First World War were fought in the Dolomites, which is quite close to where I live. And that's been very, very interesting. I think I might get stories or a book of all of that type of material, really. So I do like doing translations because it just connects me to Italian in a much deeper way. But I copy, I write articles. I mean, for certain sites, yes. But I tend to do more translations and then, whatever turns up, really.
Yeah, that's excellent. Now, do you offer any services for other writers, like editing services or proofreading, or have you ever done that?
No, I haven't. I talk at festivals. I've got a festival coming up. Well, it's a writer's retreat rather than a festival in Tuscany in June, and I'll be talking about social media and grassroots book promotion. And I try and get myself invited to little festivals and because then you can, meet other people, obviously, promote your book a little bit, and it's good. It just makes you feel like more of a writer. But no, I haven't done editing or copying. I think that would drive me crazy. I'm thinking about setting up a sort of small, very small scale sort of writer's retreat facility here where I live, but because my house is quite big, but I'd have to get rid of some of my teenage children. I think I'll eventually be heading towards doing something like that. I like that. Or either that or housing it somewhere in the mountains, because I live quite close to the mountains. I think that is a great environment for writing. So one day I'll get that set up, I think.
That sounds wonderful. You know, I love the idea of a writer's retreat. I've had authors on my show previously where we've talked about writer's groups where you have, you know, a group that meets on more on a regular basis, whether it's once a week or twice a month or whatever. And I've had authors kind of give me pros and cons on that. Now, I have never belonged to one myself. I know authors who swear by them, others who hate them. What are your thoughts on that?
I think I'd be terrified by them. One of the festivals I went to last year, they did actually had like an open working session, and I ran. There was no way I was going to put my work up there and have it pulled to pieces. I don't mind working with an editor and have an editor shred something that I've written, but whilst a work is sort of still forming, I couldn't share. I'm not able to share, not really. I need to know what I think myself, and I need to believe, actually, because belief is the thing that carries you to the end of a story, I think, or a book, whatever you're working on, and I can't open up, really, when it's not, you know, done and over. When it's done and over, you're detached from it, and it's almost a product rather than something that's sort of cooking inside of you. But I've been asked to join a writer's group, but, I mean, thankfully, or I don't know, there are none in my area anyway. I'd have to sort of put it together myself, and then everybody writes different. And I know I've got a friend who swears that she sort of has a writing group and works with people who are writing completely different stories or, you know, types of writing, memoir versus crime or women's fiction versus literary fiction. And she said she finds it very useful critiquing something that's completely different from what she's doing. But I don't know, my time is so limited that I think I need to concentrate on what I'm doing myself. I could probably do with a hand, yes, definitely. I think we all could. But I tend to protect my work and just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And do it. I don't really talk about it that much.
Yeah, you make some excellent points, and I feel the same way you do about that. The other thing too, and I've had authors tell me this on the air, is that if you do decide that you want to go that route in joining a writer's group, to check out a few different ones before you settle on one, because let's face it, human nature, and this kind of speaks to what you were saying. I mean, human nature is human nature, and people are not above jealousy and pettiness, and so you can't really be sure that the criticism you're going to receive is constructive, unless maybe you visit a group a couple of times and kind of just observe and see how people are treated.
That is so true, because I have a colleague. She's also publishing with my publisher, and she was very upset by something somebody had said, and she did believe, like you said, that it was personal rather than, you know, critiquing. And the amount of effort that then you have to make to believe in your work again, I think can be very detrimental. I think you're right. You're right there. You'd have to weigh everything up very carefully and make sure that it's beneficial and not going to bring you down, because I think writers can be, well, quite fragile, really.
Yes.
It's hard to take criticism, I mean, but you obviously have to take it on the chin when it comes. Otherwise, you shouldn't be writing. But, yes, it's got to be useful criticism.
Right. And you know, in the case of an editor, and certainly the editor you're using, it sounds like the criticism was very constructive and designed to help you become even better versus you know, tearing you down, which is some of the experiences I've had other authors tell me on the air. So.
Yeah. No, I remember I got one terrible review for my book. I mean, all of the other reviews were fine. They were good. They were hilarious, and I really enjoyed them. But everybody has to get one dud review, and it felt so personal. It felt so awful. I also wanted to go and strangle the woman. And then I had to be calmed down by one of my sons, who said, look, it's obvious she hasn't even read the thing. And then I started thinking, gosh, maybe you're right. I mean, who knows? You just have to accept it. But I think once it's already getting to a magazine and a review stage, you don't care. I mean, you've done it. It's out there. You've done well. Somebody's believed enough to publish your book, or you've been able to put it together. That's an achievement. And so reviews, let them come, let them go. It doesn't really matter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, not everyone's going to like everything anyway, and that doesn't have any bearing on the quality of your own work. You know, it's just
yeah.
it's more that's, the person's problem.
No, that's something I could actually give as advice. Before you, if you're working on your own promotion project, you know, you're promoting your own book, be really careful who you send your book to review, because I think a couple of times I've made a mistake with that. I've sent it to somebody who was the wrong person to review my book because it wasn't their material, or they were too young, or because this is obviously a book for an older woman who's lived more than a guy or more than a young person. So I think that's also important, being careful who you send your book out to be reviewed by. I mean, apart from what your publisher does, because they'll send it to all the newspapers and and magazines, and you've got nothing really to do with that. But on your own blog trail, when you send out your book to be reviewed by people, I think that's really important. Don't waste copies of your book. Send it to people who actually do what they say they're going to do, and people who have a, you know, trustworthy time frame, and also people who, well, who are doing something that's in the same sort of genre as what you're doing.
Definitely. Well, I think it boils down to knowing your audience. And
yeah, yeah.
That's
well, that's
so
something that you don't know in the beginning, and you don't realize how fundamental it is. And you also don't realize how much time you can waste by, you know, barking up the wrong tree. I think, you know, time is so important, and not wasting it is, yeah, something that you do have to learn.
No, and I know from my own experience that's definitely the case. I think it's true, too, if you have a book where maybe there's several different themes going on, or you feel as if, you know, certain markets might have, you know, certain aspects of your book might appeal to certain markets. But I believe, I've learned, I should say, through my own experience, that you really have to hone in, though, and you have to kind of force yourself to figure out who your main demographic is and really just promote to those people.
Yeah.
And then anybody else that might come along, that's great, but that's kind of like extra.
No, I think it's true. You definitely have to tease out the themes and milk them, I mean, wherever you can, but it's definitely not going to appeal to everybody. So, yeah.
So, Catherine, you know, and I have to compliment you. I mean, and here's another thing I'd like to address, too, in terms of, you know, this would fall under the marketing category, too. I once interviewed a woman, and she was a romance novelist, and she had an impressive, you know, lineup of books that she had written over several decades, very successful. And yet when I brought her on the air, and this was a couple of years ago, it wasn't even on Writestream, you know, for her to string one sentence together seemed to be an effort. So I guess I want to ask you, because I always ask everybody to bring on the show, how important is it to be able to articulate your work, you know, through the written, through the spoken word? And I know not everybody's a public speaker, and I think it's right at the top there of the top 10 list of human fears, but how important do you think it is to overcome that and find ways of, you know, find ways of coping with it so that you can speak about your work? Because we as authors, we're our work. So go ahead. Yeah.
It becomes work, then, yes. It is a job, really. If you want to make, well, money is pretty hard to make, but if you want to make a go of it, you really have to consider as this part of it as a job. And I remember when I actually did the book launch in London, I was terrified. I would wake up in a sweat, I mean, for weeks beforehand, thinking, oh, my God, I'm not going to know what to say, because I hadn't done any public speaking since high school. I mean, for a very long time, I dodged anything to do with public speaking, and I actually wrote a speech, and in my speech, it's in my blog somewhere, I'm sure, because I showed it to a colleague, and she laughed so hard, she said, put that in your blog, it's hilarious, because I wrote down what I wanted to say, and I wrote breathe, you know, in capital letters, every five lines or something, I wrote breathe. And I organized it, basically I organized it myself, I did most of it. And I trucked out some Prosecco from Italy, and I had a nephew who's very tall and handsome and waiterly. He waited on everybody, and I got everybody quite sort of tipsy. And by the time I had to make my speech, I didn't really need a sheet of paper. I mean, I clung to it. But I was able to overcome so much that evening just thinking, because a friend said something very useful to me. She said, Catherine, it's your evening, it's your book, own it, do it, embrace it. And it seems obvious, but I think I needed somebody to just hit me with it. And then I acted, and then I really enjoyed it. I actually really, really enjoyed it. And I've done interviews in Italian on the radio, which have been quite funny, and developed friendships also with announcers, radio announcers in Australia. And that's been a really good experience. I was interviewed in the piazza in Matera, the place where the Women's Fiction Festival was, with a huge microphone and a great big crowd of people. And I tell you, I had a huge glass of red wine beforehand. alcohol helps. You're allowed to have a little drink beforehand. But I was initially very reluctant to speak, and now I quite enjoy it. And I think it's essential. You've got to. And, well, I think it's very crucial to make people laugh, I think. Well, especially with this book, I ended up talking about, I don't know, sex and tractors and living in the country, and I was very happy when people laughed.
Humor is definitely, you have to be able to make people laugh. And I think we have, as writers too, anybody, but especially as writers, you have to be able to laugh at yourself, I think, and not things seriously.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm very good at laughing at myself. I've been in some pretty ridiculous situations talking about this book, and it's all part of the book's journey and your journey as a writer. I'm now really happy to be sort of changing the type of book that I'm promoting, and I'll see how this goes. I think I might have to be a tiny bit more serious, but not too much, I hope.
I hope not, because you have such a delightful personality, and you have such a nice way of expressing yourself.
Oh, thank you.
That easy sense of humor, it's wonderful. So in the last 5 minutes, Catherine, I can't believe how quickly the time has flown by. Is there anything that we...
aspects.
Yeah, I think you're right. But if we missed anything, I'm going to just give you an opportunity to maybe share anything or talk about anything that maybe we haven't touched upon at this point.
I'm thinking. Well, I can't really talk about self-publishing, but I've had, working with a small publisher, I've had quite a lot to do with the cover design. I think visually your book has to speak a lot when it's out there, because it is competing. Even on a web page, it has to be quite arresting. I think that's really important. And as far as social media, I really have to get on the Twitter bandwagon, but I have to improve my internet connection. Blogging can be useless, because, as you say, your friend who had written many books but wasn't able to string a sentence together, it's the same with blogs. Some writers are absolutely boring with blogs. So either you say something astonishing once a month, or you're one of these people who can reel out something every 2 days. I mean, it depends on you, I think. I think the main thing with writing is just to use your time as wisely as possible. And keep on writing. I read a fantastic article a few weeks ago, which I'm going to refer to when I do my Tuscany talk, about the dangers of not writing anymore, because we're all so wound up with presenting ourselves and developing a platform. And this widely published author, and I'm sorry, I can't give you the name, was talking about the dangers of new authors working so hard to produce a writer platform that they actually had nothing to promote and no sort of writerly experience behind them. So I think that's something to bear in mind, all of us. Just keep writing. Do the writing, because if you don't do the writing, it's not going to happen.
Well, that's the absolute truth. Definitely. Yeah. And, you know, you made a good point earlier when we were talking about the blogging, and I just wanted to expand upon just for a second. And you're absolutely right. It can't just be about broadcasting, oh, and here's my book, and buy my book, and hey, did you read my book? You know, I think you need to engage people on various topics, too. It may not even have anything to do with writing. Maybe it's about cooking. Maybe it's about something funny that happened to you while you were out shopping. Your shoes. Right. I think you can – there's so many – I mean, it's endless almost, the topics that you can use to engage people.
Yeah, and it's very funny that you say that, because some of my blog posts are absolutely frivolous. I've written about a handbag that I fell in love with and bought in London, because I go to London quite frequently for my daughter. And a bunch of women who I know are very serious writers, because I follow all of their blogs as well, they all went nuts. They were really engaged, and they wrote about what their experiences with handbags, and oh, good on you, and go and buy the thing, and blah, 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 blah. And I think it's lovely to see people who you know are hardworking writers being absolutely frivolous and being able to turn it off or turn it on and engage with you and have a laugh. And it does make blogging really worthwhile, actually, when you see the different facets to the people around you and you're allowed to express yourself as well. So I think blogging can be marvelous. It really, I enjoy it. But I won't do a blog post unless I think I have something to say. I don't want to bore people, really.
Yeah. No, that's a good point, and I agree with that. So, Kat, so you're going to work on getting a better internet connection so we can find you on Twitter. But
yes,
you are at Kat in Italy, correct?
That's me. And I don't write very often. I write only silly things, and I don't engage with other people on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. On Facebook, I do talk to a lot of people on Facebook, and I link my blog posts and put up photographs of Italy. I mean, the Italy that I see, or the Italy that I, you know, don't really want to see but have to see. But it's not only about Italy. I'm not one of these people who are madly in love with Italy. It's where I live, and I adore it, and, well, everybody loves and hates aspects of where they live anyway, so.
Right, that's so true. Yeah. Now, Kat, what's your Facebook page, or how can we connect with you on Facebook?
Catherine McNamara. It's just my name, that's all.
Catherine McNamara.
That's it. Yeah. Oh, no, I'd love to meet more people. Anybody who's a serious reader and wants to meet up in Venice, I do things like that sometimes. I've met a couple of people from the U.S. who are readers and bloggers, and I've ended up having marvelous conversations, really. So it's good to connect. It really is.
Definitely. The world has become so much smaller, too, since the advent of new technology and social media. It's wonderful. And we're a good example of that. And I can't believe the time has gone by so fast, Catherine, but I want to thank you for joining me today.
Wonderful. It really has.
Well, I'm so glad. And when your short stories come out, you know, please stay in touch with me. We'll stay in touch.
Definitely.
I would love to bring you back to promote that and anything else you might be working on.
Thank you very, very much, Nadia. It's really lovely to meet you, lovely to talk with you, and I hope your audience have been sort of interested.
You too. Oh, I'm sure they were. You were excellent, and I really enjoyed it. So, listen, you have a wonderful evening, right? It's evening there right now, right? You're about 8 o'clock?
I just cooked dinner, and I'm going to have a beer. I should be having a glass of wine, but I think it's beer time.
All right. Well, enjoy, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Thank you, Daria. All the
best
to you. Good luck with your writing, and good luck with this program. It's a wonderful opportunity, and I think you're doing a great thing.
Thank you. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Ciao, Bella. Ciao.
Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was author Catherine McNamara. Please check out her blog, The Divorced Lady's Companion to Living in Italy, blogspot.com, and her books, which you can find on amazon.com. And that is going to wrap up another RightStream Tuesday. Thank you for listening. I will be back here again next week at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, U.S. And until then, keep writing and stay in that flow of creativity.